underwriting support for the Book Show podcast on WAMC.org comes from Northshire Bookstore, Manchester Center, Vermont, and Saratoga Springs, New York. An independent bookstore offering books, author events, gifts for children and adults, and more. Northshire.com. And from the College of St. Rose, Albany, New York, offering a new Bachelor of Science degree in Public Health with a focus on social, physical, and behavioral sciences. strose.edu.
Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. Adam Gopnik's new memoir, At the Stranger's Gate: Arrivals in New York, is a memoir that captures the romance of New York City in the 1980s. The book is essentially a prequel to Adam's bestseller, Paris to the Moon, and documents his early adventures in the 80s in New York with his wife. He takes us through their first apartments, his first jobs, and first meetings with the most celebrated names in the city. Adam Gopnik has been writing for The New Yorker magazine since 1986. Again, his new memoir is At the Stranger's Gate, and it is a pleasure to welcome Adam Gopnik to this week's book show. What a great treat to have you on the program. Thank you.
It's a pleasure to be here, Joe. Thanks.
At what point did you think that you wanted to write about this time, to write about the 80s, to write about your arrival in the city that you now call home?
I first thought about doing it shortly after we arrived in the early 80s. I had schemes. You know, every writer is scheming to turn experience into, if not literature, then at least into 12-point prose at every moment. So it was an old ambition in that way because I thought something interesting was happening. More specifically, it was about actually 15 years ago, some friends said, you know, you have these very funny stories about coming to New York and all the bizarre things that happened to you. You should turn them into a book. And then I spent a long time not knowing how to find a voice and a tone that would let me tell those stories on the page. Because as you know, Joe, writing is tone and voice before it's anything else.
Right.
And I needed a voice that was different from the voice of Paris and the Moon or of the sequel to Paris and the Moon, Through the Children's Gate. In my annals of egocentrism, because those voices were essentially a paternal voice, a voice of somebody who was trying to make sense of the world for other people, and this was a voice of someone struggling to make sense of the world for himself. And then I began telling some of those stories on stage for The Moth, the wonderful storytelling group that we have here in New York, and it seemed for the first time I kind of could hear how one might write them, that the stories were more like fables than they were like recollections, and that they had a tone that in some odd way was more like early Chagall than it was like Diane Arbus photography, if that makes any sense. It was sort of stylized and humorous and romantic, fable-like, as I say. And once I heard that tone and got that voice, I sort of could hear the book, and I could understand how I could write the book. And I began working on it about 3 years ago.
And how do you think that voice has changed? Even when you look at it in comparison to the other memoirs, because it's certainly your voice, but it is different.
Well, as I say, it began with the idea of telling this book rather than writing this book.
Right.
These were stories told, and so some of the kind of the loose-limbed, occasionally even repetitive, asymmetrical forms of in paragraphs that I wouldn't have used in earlier books comes through here. I think the tone, I hope that the tone of address is more intimate, more vocal in that way. It sounds like a friend telling you crazy stories of his youth over dinner. The other thing that happened to me, Joe, in the course of writing the book is that I realized when I actually started trying to write the stories as stories, the way I told the stories, is that they seemed thin. There's an enormous difference between spoken voice and a written voice. And I began to try and, so to speak, sort of aerate or amplify the stories with what came to feel to me like little kind of mini anthropologies of the period of the 1980s. So the first story in the book, as you know, is all about how I lost my pants on my first day in New York and feel I've never gotten them back since. I've been walking around naked from the waist down for 30-some years. It's a true story about we went out to buy the most beautiful suit in New York as a kind of protection against all of New York's indignities and difficulties, and I lost the pants the first day I had them. But in telling that story, I wanted to kind of amplify it, light it from the side, if that makes any sense, By talking about what New York was like in the fall of 1980, what Bloomingdale's was like, what luxury ice cream was like, and all of those little kinds of anthropological details of the city at the time began to flow into the spoken voice. And I think, I hope, I believe, that the book gets its architectural structure from the tension between those two voices, the narrator's voice telling you these bizarre stories of lost pants and becoming the grooming editor of a men's fashion magazine without knowing anything either about grooming or men's fashion. And then the kind of more anthropological voice, the more analytic voice that's telling you about what the world of fashion was like at that time, what the art world was like at that time, what the literary world was like at that time. So it's those two voices coming together, I think, give the book its texture.
I love the use, your use of the word aerate. That's a wonderful analogy.
Well, that's sort of how I see writing very often. You know, you have a main line, my kind of writing anyway, which is not everyone's kind of writing. Maybe it's not anyone's kind of writing. But you have a main line. You have a narrative propulsion. You have a story to tell, in plain English. But just telling the story, it's where it makes an essay, Joe, I think, different from short story or any other form. Is it an essay? You want it aerated. You want opinion. You want a little editorializing. You want what I sometimes call a left turn into traffic. So if you're telling a story about how you lost your pants, if Gogol is telling it or our friend Salman Rushdie, it's all pants, so to speak. But when an essayist tells you that story, he wants to tell you something about the way Bloomingdale's functioned at that time, what the difference between Barney's and Bloomingdale's in 1980s was. You want that kind of analyzed social detail in an essay. It's one of the things that an essay gives you. An essay is a constant braid of emotion and opinion. And as a consequence, you want to constantly be aerating your little fable with the larger context of the world in which the fable was made.
The book obviously tells this amazing story of you and your wife coming to New York City. And you're coming to New York City in a tough time. The city is blighted. The city has crime and despair. This was the 1970s. And yet so many of the firsts in your life, that first job, the first apartment, take place with that New York City as a backdrop.
Yeah, it was really taxi driver time, Joe. You know, I mean, it was when the city was widely perceived as a hellish place. You can imagine how little my parents, and particularly how little Martha's parents, Martha was 19, wanted her to leave comfortable, beautiful, and safe Montreal to come to taxi driver city. In fact, Martha started work as a film editor on our arrival in New York in that fall. And within 24 hours, they had found a dead body in the dumpster in the basement of the building on 45th Street, the film center. I joke, but it's true that nowadays that would be an amenity for hipsters moving in, right? We promise you a constant flow of dead bodies in the dumpsters. People have a nostalgia for that lost New York. But it was a dangerous place. It was in many respects a sordid place and in lots of ways only got worse. And yet we did make our life within it. The core possibilities of New York, its pluralism, its possibilities, were very rich for us as much as they had been for Scott Fitzgerald coming as a pilgrim to New York in the 1920s. So that's part of, I hope, the comedy of the story. It's this very, in many respects, very naive young couple coming, renting the smallest apartment in the history of Manhattan, a 9-by-11 basement room. And nobody will believe, Joe, that that actually is so. When I do the spoken version of the of this book, which I do on stage as well, I have somebody, I take somebody out of the audience, and we lay down together, without my first explaining it, a 9-by-11 rectangle in blue masking tape. And then they go back to the seat, and then I say to everyone, you've been wondering, I say to the audience, why we've just made this tiny rectangle. That was the entire apartment that Martha, my wife, and I lived in for 3 years, and that is true, and no one really believes it. So in this tiny microcosm, we struggled to make as much meaning and beauty as we possibly could at that time. And I think that it's always been true about New York that it's what gives it its special poetry is the back and forth between the big, largely indifferent, in many respects brutal outer city, and then these extraordinary little cells, like monk cells, these extraordinary little microcosms of pleasure and aspiration that exist within it. And at no time in the city's history has the discrepancy, the space between those two things, between the ugliness of the outer city and the beauty of the inner cities, the inner chambers, the blue rooms, been more poignant than it was in 1980.
Adam Gopnik is our guest on this week's book show. The name of the new memoir is At the Stranger's Gate, Arrivals in New York. Obviously, much has changed from the late 70s, early 80s that you write about this. But you get the sense that for you, you don't feel much different.
No, isn't that one of the odd things? I think I say at the end of the book, I was lucky enough to end up spending most of the next 30 years doing exactly what I wanted to do, and it still feels as if I haven't done it. I'm located psychically much more in that 9x11 room with my missing pants and my unsuccessful job at a library and then my hopeful job pretending to know something about grooming, men's grooming, in which I would make up, Joe, these insane diktats for people, you know, shave 6 times a day in the shower or, you know, always apply perfume to the inner surface of your elbow. I just would make these crazy things up and put them out in the magazine. I feel much more located there than anywhere else. I think that's a universal feeling, that ambition doesn't translate ever into satisfaction or a sense of complacent arrival. Ambition doesn't become a rival. Ambition just becomes another kind of ambition. And we turn around in middle age and we ask what happened, where we came from, and then we relocate ourselves in the ambit, in the cockpit, if you like, of that first ambition. So my dreams are set in that 9x11 room, in that blue room, more often than they're set any other place on Earth. And in the dream, I always wake up in that tiny basement room with Martha, my wife, and I say, oh, yeah, we're living here. This is where we live. For a while we lived in this bigger place, but I guess we left it. Why did we leave it? Mm. Oh, well, I have that dream twice a week.
So a rather Buddhist philosophy there.
Yeah, you know, I wrote a long piece about Buddhism, and I have my own very half-assed meditation practice. But yes, I think that's true. You know, the self we make is always being remade as we do it, and there's no greater illusion than the illusion of accomplishment, the illusion of arrival. That actually would have been a good subtitle for the book, The Illusion of Arrival. I think that's true. And at the risk of sounding sentimental, but this book risks, I think, being sentimental, and that was the audacity of the book for me, was it was going to be an openly sentimental book in lots of ways. At the risk of being sentimental, as Paul McCartney sings, only love remains. What you remember of that time are not the things you did, which seem absurd, or the things you aspired to, which seem transient once acquired, but you remember the people you loved. And I hope that this book is a loving portrait of Martha, of the people we encountered along the way, everyone from Richard Avedon, the great photographer, who became a kind of adoptive father for us, to our great good fortune through Jeff Koons, who became a kind of embodiment of the oddities of the art world in the 80s. But I hope that the emotional vibration from the book is one of slightly bewildered affection.
One of those affectionate moments is where you tell us the story of when you first felt like a true New Yorker, that moment when you felt like a real, honest-to-God New Yorker.
If you're referencing the moment, I hope that when we were driven from our loft by a covey of mice. Yeah, I had done the story is that I, the night before, I'd gotten a call about giving a keynote address at 8 a.m., which totally in character, I'm ashamed to say, I'd totally forgotten that I had agreed to do. So I had to improvise my way through a keynote address at 50th and Lexington at 8 a.m., and I got a check that enabled us to go out for a great dinner. I wish we'd had higher ambitions, but we didn't. And then we came home, and our loft, by then we had moved from this tiny basement room to a rodent-infested loft in Soho, and it was overrun with mice. You know, it was as though one of those bad cartoon scenes from the 1930s movies where the mice are playing little string bass and violins and dancing around. And we couldn't go in there. So we had to walk all the way to a friend's house on 75th Street. And yet my feeling at that time was not one of disappointment and frustration. It was, oh, we are the mice. We are the mice. We live in New York City the way the mice live in our apartment. No one invited us, but we occupy it. We inhabit it. And that was a moment from the first time I really did feel totally at home, no longer a stranger, but an exiled citizen of New York.
As I mentioned, this book obviously talks about many of your firsts, and you talk about your first New York City jobs, the Frick, MoMA, GQ. There were others. What were those experiences like in the idea of forming you as a writer as to what you would become and what ultimately you wanted to do?
Well, I arrived in New York with a number of conflicting and circuitous ambitions. I wanted to be a songwriter, and I was going to graduate school in art history, so I was doing that. And over the course of time, what I discovered that the only thing I was good at, because I was spectacularly bad at most of the jobs I got, but the one thing I was good at was putting words together in sequence. And sometimes those words were, on the surface at least, extremely trivial. You know, I tell the story about how I broke through at Men's Fashion magazine by putting together the impeccable logic of summer shirts. That was the title, with the subtitle Chiaroscuro Chic. It's not the sort of thing that you would think, it's not exactly a Homeric accomplishment, right? But it felt terrific at the time, because as I say, the thing about being a writer is it isn't so much what you're writing about, it's suddenly finding yourself able to use the givens of language to insert themselves in people's consciousness, like these wonderful little soft bullets that you're firing into people's heads. And I found that that was the one thing I could do well. And so the ambit of the book, the orbit of the book, as I say, is from but to and, from about having to unlearn all the contestatory, the kind of debating cliches of graduate schools. We're always saying, the thesis is this, but he says this, but to ands, which are the mucilage, the glue of storytelling. This happened and that happened and then that happened and then that happened. And it's through the accretive observations of life that we make our real stories, our real fables. Fables are not made from buts. The fables are made from ands. So that transited my own life from being a bad graduate student to being an aspiring writer, I hope an authentic writer, is my story within the book.
You talk about those jobs, and I guess it was really at MoMA that you had a very formative experience. Is that true to say?
Yeah, I discovered that I like talking about pictures, and I could stand in front of pictures and just talk about them, free associate about them. I would call out, don't look at the labels, don't look at the labels. It was kind of, I come from a long line of boardwalk pitchmen, truly, in Atlantic City. That's what my uncles all did. You know, they would demonstrate spray starch and the like, say, ladies, please come. Are you tired of ironing your clothes? Well, I did the same thing with Van Gogh. Don't look at the labels. Come here and let's look at the Starry Night. And it was very bad art history, but it was, I think, engaging storytelling. And I found that that was what I liked to do, kind of build a trellis of adjectives and adverbs, nouns and verbs, around a visual object. And so I did as an art critic to the degree that I did that well. That was what I did. And discovering that about yourself, discovering that, A, what it is that you do well, and B, discovering what you don't do well. I sometimes think, you know, Joe, that the secret to happiness is knowing what you can't do. I discovered very efficiently what I can't do, which is many things. And the one thing I could do was put words in a particular order. And I guess my deepest belief is that putting the right words in the right order, there's only one right order in which words can go in the course of trying to describe or inform or persuade, and searching for that run right order over and over again, sleeplessly, tirelessly, constantly, became, you know, the shoes I made. That was the trousers I hemmed, and I was discovering that that was what the one thing I did well is very much what this book is about.
And it's the thing that you do well, and it's the thing that you do right, but it can often be about what you can't do right.
Yes, that I had not thought of that, but it's exactly. That's sort of the moral of this book. Put the right words about the wrong behavior in the right order, and comedy results. That's what comedy is, incongruity, right? Write elegantly about your awkwardness, and you have a story to tell. And these are, I don't know if they're elegant, but they're certainly hard-worked stories about some extremely awkward intervals in my own existence. Martha, of course, is, I will say, a woman of enormous innate grace. And so she graces these pages. And very often in the midst of my worst misadventures, she just falls asleep. So she sleeps through about half the book, I tease her, and doesn't have to witness me improvising my way through a keynote address on pluralism and individualism, which I had begun preparing for two hours before, and so on. And she was sound asleep through the whole thing. I think that life is a comedy. You know, life is a constant comedy. But what gives it its pathos is the force of our longing for it. You know, I say at some one point in the book, Joe, I say something about how it may seem indulgent to revive or memorialize, write down our old longings, but life is a sequence of longings. And the only way we can recapture our lives is not only through the things we did, but through remembering the things we longed for. And this book is full of a lot of longings.
We spoke at the beginning of our conversation about finding the voice that was right for this book. And you mentioned The Moth, and I'd like to return to that as we conclude. And that is for you finding your voice on stage and in telling these stories and in telling stories that elicit a response and elicit laughter and an understanding of that human condition.
Yeah, I love storytelling. I'm a horrible ham, so I'm hard to discourage from standing up and talking. And there's one point in my life I wanted to be a stand-up comedian. I never succeeded at that any more than I did at many other things. But I love storytelling. And the two great things about storytelling, especially for a writer like myself whose work as a critic in The New Yorker can often be sort of discursive. Great thing about storytelling is, one, you have to have relentless narrative propulsion. The story has to move forward or the audience becomes restless. And laughter is the immediate payoff. If the audience is laughing, they've recognized the truth, however ridiculous, of the situation you're describing. So having the exigencies of narrative, what and then, you know, that and I was talking about, and having the reward of laughter was the thing I wanted to try and transmit from the stage to the page. And with all due aeration around the edges. And that's what I tried to do. And as I say, I do a sort of 1 hour long stage version of most of these same stories, which has other virtues, I think, and maybe not quite as much depth.
I've done hundreds of episodes of this program, and I don't believe I've ever said this, so I'm quite proud to say it to you, but I love the spine of your book. It is beautiful. It includes basically a photo booth, a series of photos of you and Martha.
That's right. Thank you. I mean, the spine may be the best thing about the book. I'm not sure I'm quite able to take that. When the interview says the spine is great,
I love the book, but in fact, I didn't. No. It almost got away from me, I have to say, because it wasn't until it was on my desk and I looked down and I said, "Oh my God, that is beautiful."
Bad book, great spine. That spine is actually, it's a photo booth. You know, from the days when they're actually working photo booths that Martha and I went to at the Port Authority bus terminal shortly after our arrival in New York, and we did us there, and that's the two of us. I have a lot more hair. She looks remarkably unchanged. And I think what it communicates is this kind of idiot rapture at being in New York. And I feel, when I look at it, I feel those two poor young people. Well, they have no idea what's going on, but they're intoxicated by the city and they think well of each other. They think highly of each other, at least. So, yes, that was a photomat thing that we'd had sitting around forever. And Chip Kidd, the remarkable designer, saw and said, "Oh, that's the spine of your book." And I said, "What?" And he said, "Oh yeah, that'll work beautifully." And it's communicative. It's eloquent about the circumstance you were in at that time.
Adam Gopnik's new memoir is At the Stranger's Gate. It is published by Knopf. It is a beautiful book with a beautiful spine. And I thank you very much for sharing with us. A great pleasure to have you on the program, as always.
Pleasure talking to you, Joe.
Again, Adam Gopnik's new book is At the Stranger's Gate, Arrivals in New York. It is published by Knopf. We enjoy hearing from our listeners about our shows. You can email us at book@wamc.org. And you can listen again to this or find past book shows via podcast or at wamc.org. Sarah LeDuc produces our program. Thanks also to Paul Ruest at Argo Studios. Bookmark us for next week. And thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.